David McNaughton is my latest guest in this series of nostalgia interviews. David was Professor of Ethics and Philosophy of Religion at Florida State University and now lives in southern Scotland. We begin our conversation by discussing the incongruities of celebrating Christmas in Florida and how it might be deemed an inversion of what is natural and right. We find out about growing up in Gateshead, going to primary school in the Yorkshire Dales, and grammar school in Nottingham. We find out how he developed an interest in French poetry, in Dante and Conrad, and how the best way to get people to read a text is to ban it. And we talk about how being in a darkened theatre amounts to total absorption. Now, David came from a family of school teachers, and we find out how he ended up becoming a philosopher, indeed a professor of philosophy, and why philosophy attracts a certain type of person, and who David's biggest influences were. We find out about David's formative educational influences. We find out about how things have changed in academia over the years. David talks about the wider cultural influences that he was exposed to when he was in Oxford, and whether there are any specific negative things about which it is not possible to be nostalgic, and which hardships it is possible to be nostalgic about. We discuss the analogy between Facebook and fruit machines, and we learn about the concept of retrospective enjoyment. And we find out at the end of the interview whether David has any regrets about anything in his life to date. So join me. My name is Chris Deasy, and Professor David McNaughton is the latest in my series of nostalgia interview guests. Well, I'm in Melrose in the Scottish Borders with, I think, probably in about 20 years.
Yes, I think
the first time I've seen it was David McNaughton. And we have a mutual friend who I've already interviewed, of course, who's now Professor of Philosophy at Kent, Simon Kirchin. And I think you were his external examiner.
I was indeed, yes.
It's your fault.
Dissertation. Yeah. Largely incomprehensible, but and he was writing about McDowell, who was also incomprehensible. So,
well, don't worry, Simon, that'll be edited out. No, but no, wonderful to meet you. And of course, you were at Keele when I last saw you, and
yes.
And you've been on quite a journey since then. I think you spent a decade or more in America.
Yes, so I got a post in America in 2003, largely because one of my colleagues, my partner in crime, Piers Rawling, who I wrote a lot with, was invited to be a member of a department, and they very kindly said they'd like both of us. So I lived in Tallahassee, Florida, for 14 years, which has its good and its bad points. So the winters are very delightful. The winters are like a British summer, and they last about as long as a normal British summer. And then they turn on the sauna, and it's just totally ghastly. Very hot, very humid, and of course full of unpleasant creatures that can kill you. Such as, you know, alligators and ticks and poisonous snakes in your swimming pool and other delights.
Well, people who've been to Florida tell me that at Christmas time it is very surreal because you've got the summer climate, but they still have the Christmas trees and the roast turkey, but you're doing it at the swimming pool or at the sauna. And that sort of incongruity, I guess, if you're used to Christmas being white or the possibility of white, takes some adjusting to. But you must have spent a few Christmases in Florida.
Oh, yes. It's, of course, not as bad as Australia, because at least it is what passes for winter in Florida. But, yes, you can often sit outside, and it could be 75, 80 in old money. I only do old money. And Americans, of course, have not succumbed to all this metric nonsense. So at least I can understand the temperatures. I've actually eaten my Christmas dinner, you know, sitting out on a patio on a couple of occasions.
Yeah, because when I was doing my research on Christmas a few years ago, I came across a quotation from Robin Cook, the then, he obviously Labour Foreign Secretary at one point, and he said he didn't like it when Brits left Britain at Christmas time in search of warmer climes, because he said it's the best time of year because you'll speak to strangers in the street and wish them a happy Christmas, but the rest of the year normally you would just walk by. And he said there's a sense of camaraderie and there's a collective element and a communal essence to Christmas which you don't have elsewhere. But I can imagine it must be I mean, you hear it on the radio a lot, of course, people who are estranged, physically estranged from their family or geographically estranged from their family at Christmas, and they're often maybe in a place like Florida, but they use radio very often as a means, and I guess Facebook would work the same sort of way, as a way of saying, you know, I can't be with you, but I'm thinking of you. Because I would imagine that if you're in somewhere like Florida where it's very hot, potentially you're sort of you're missing what you escaped from. And do you have this sort of urge, do you sort of wish that you were sitting in cold, you know, Staffordshire and we were blocked in because of the snow? Or did you just think, I escaped and I'm so glad I'm here?
Well, I did like the winters in Florida, but largely because of a contrast with the summer. And yes, I did miss there being a real winter. I mean, the leaves don't fall off the trees. And it's really just you go from tropical to rather dry, sort of June-like weather. And I did miss traditional British Christmases. Not that I've been a tremendously Christmassy sort of person. But yes, when I was younger, I used to read a lot of Margaret Drabble. And I noticed that in her books, the family climax usually occurs when they go for some after-dinner walk in the depths of winter. And then, as it were, you know, all the dysfunctional elements of the family fly apart. And I thought, well, I really do like seeing bare trees and there being frost underfoot and hoarfrost and that sort of thing. It didn't actually snow in Florida last winter, I'm told, or what passes for snow. So they had a few flakes. It doesn't settle, of course, but they always have a snow day from school because everyone's terrified that if they actually go out and drive, awful things will happen to them, to the intense amusement of people who live up in the north of the United States where, you know, they're snowed in for 4 or 5 months.
Because I always find that when the snow comes, I kind of resent it in the sense that it's very, you know, especially if it falls during term time and I'm aware that there's huge disruption and you know that the term is badly affected by it. But when it goes away and we have sort of, inverted commas, normality back, I really miss it because there's something, especially with young children, that the idea of snow, if not the actuality, is wonderful because, you know, this sense of revelling in something. It's this moment when you almost sort of, you know, time is suspended. It's almost liminal because it's like, oh, we can't go to school. OK, we're not even able to leave the street. So you go on an adventure and you explore and you do all the sort of things that you don't do the rest of the time. But the snow actually brings people out. And actually, what we should be saying is, you know, put the fire on, close the door and and you know, read a book or something. I think that may even indirectly have been a reason why I did the research on Christmas, because I found that it was all these paradoxes around Christmas that we do things that seem to be almost an inversion of what seems natural and right, and we keep on doing it year in, year out. Fascinating.
Yeah, I remember the first year there was serious snow in Stoke-on-Trent, and my son would be, I don't know, a couple of years old. And so we spent the whole of our time in the back garden on a day, you know, when probably, as you say, you would have stayed inside. But of course, it was enormous fun. And he very much wanted to go sledging. And so one winter, we were in the Lake District and the snow was at about 1,500 feet. So I said, well, I know a sort of widish path we can go up and we'll try sledging on it. So, you know, we climbed up, got there, and it sort of worked, but not terribly well. And then I said, well, why don't we carry on and go to the top? Right. And I had failed to realise that because of the wind, that when we got to the top, the snow would be 2 feet deep and crusty. So from time to time, we fell through the snow, and of course, it was up to his waist. And then, out of a clear blue sky, a mist came down. And I said, well, we've got to head down into this valley now. And I, you know, mistook one valley for another and then said, no, sorry, it's the next valley. And he said, I'm not enjoying this very much. So when we struggled back, I thought, well, it was a very stupid thing to do. I'll never do it again. Just the sort of thing you do because there's snow and, you know, it's exciting. Mm. I discovered he'd written to Blue Peter saying, you know, they invited kids to write about their holidays, saying his father had tried to kill him by taking him on this polar expedition. Fortunately, I also discovered Blue Peter don't read these letters because he got a nice reply saying, we're very grateful for your interesting description of your recent holiday.
Rather than saying...
I thought, you know, social services...
I was going to say, we'll pass your letter on to the relevant authorities. Well, I've always thought these nostalgia interviews are the best form of confession. So, you know, go ahead. No, but going back a bit further, where are you from originally? And where do you hark from? Because we've actually... Yeah. I was trying to work out your accent earlier.
And
you've already answered that question, but you can give it away for the audience.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm certainly not from down south, as you can tell. My friend and colleague Piers Rawling, whose public school is always trying to explain to Americans that we don't all sound alike. So he will say, say Bath, David, and I'll say Bath. And he'll say, say one, David, and I'll say one. So I was born in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. My parents lived in Gateshead. So I spent the first 3 years in Gateshead. And all the family, you know, were from Tyneside. So this was the late 40s, early 50s, when people didn't move. One of the things I found rather touching about Stoke-on-Trent is that Stoke-on-Trent is a time capsule, and people live there in the way they used to live in the first half of a century. So when people marry, they might move a couple of streets away. I remember talking to some woman who was very upset because her daughter had moved somewhere else. And I said, where? And she said, well, she's moved from Longton to Fenton, all of which is part of Stoke-on-Trent. When I came back when I was 21 with my mother, the same people were still living on the street in Gateshead. One had died and one had moved. And you know, the woman next door came out and looked at me, and of course I was much taller than my mother by then, said, oh, this must be your little boy. So it was...
It sounds like... You know the film Secrets and Lies, you know, the Mike Leigh film?
Yes.
Where, now, it reminds me of that, because the daughter is trying to trace her mother, and all she's got to go on is the birth certificate and the address on that. And she's now in her 30s, and she tracks down the address... Yeah. Rings the number, and her mother, answers the phone. And of course, she's been living there all her life. But in the Mike Leigh sort of world, that sort of social mobility doesn't happen. But to me, you know, I was at university at the time, and you know, you'd move from constituency to constituency, county to county, country to country in some cases. And it just sounded really odd that three or four decades on, you'd have the same address or even the same phone number.
Yes, exactly. So after Newcastle, my parents decided, like many people after the war, that they would like to open an hotel. There was a sort of big boom in the hotel business, I think because the war was over and people wanted to get away from urban life and all the rest of it. So we ended up in Reith, which is a pretty small village in Swaledale, which is, you know, the most rugged and least populated of the Yorkshire Dales, and really isolated. And again, of course, it's not just people who have lived there all their lives. The families have lived there for generations, and no one would want to take any steps to change things because there wasn't really any point. So the water used to freeze on a regular basis because it came down from a reservoir on the fell side in open pipes. My father suggested they might, you know, dig a trench. And I said, well, you know, so what's the point? You know, it's only going to last a few weeks. So, you know, put up with it. So it was a... I mean, I was very young. I was only there from 3 to 7, but it did have an enormous influence on me. One thing was it started my love of, you know, wild hill country. So my parents were generally too busy in the summer to take me on walks, and I wasn't perhaps quite old enough. And in the winter, it was really too rough. So I used to look at these fells and think, you know, how much I'd like to be climbing up them. And there was a small beck that ran at the bottom of our hotel. So in terms of scenery, it was just completely stunning. But in terms of amenities, it was dreadful. You had to go to Richmond, which was 10 miles away, to go to the dentist. If you were fortunate enough to go to grammar school, you had to go to, you know, to Richmond and back every day, which was kind of an hour and a half bus trip each way, even though it was only 10 miles. And few people did go to the grammar school because it was a one-room primary and junior school. So everybody from 5 to 11 was taught by one teacher in one room. So not a great deal of educating went on. Had we stayed, I suspect, you know, things would have been pretty grim. But my parents soon discovered, firstly, that hotel work is just enormously hard during the season, 18-hour days. And then back in the 50s, nobody went on a holiday after the August bank holiday, really. And so they had 7 months of no income. And then, you know, this intense labour would start again. So they met lots of interesting people. Mm. And I think they enjoyed that side of it. But they really just found the hard work and the lack of cash very difficult to cope with. So we moved to Nottingham, which is where I suspect most of my accent comes from. So that was, you know, going back to the urban life, which schooling was much better. And I quite liked Nottingham as a town, but it was quite an adventure to get into the countryside. And I can remember almost all the occasions on which we went to the countryside, because by this time we didn't have a car. And so everything was public transport. So planning to go to somewhere like Alton Towers, which was, you know, a real stately home back then and not a theme park, that was an enormous trip.
This thing about treks, I feel that the longer the journey sometimes, although obviously, particularly when you're a child, you get very restless, it's all the more, certainly when you look back on it, I remember train trips because my dad worked on the railway, so we'd have free travel, and we used to go up to Worcester a lot, and the excitement of, you know, the old trains, like out of a Hitchcock movie, when you've got the single compartments, and you would go up, we used to change at Hereford and get another train, that was the crew train to Hereford, then we got the Worcester train to Malvern, and we would do that, and it was the journey was the exciting part of it. These days, you can stream a movie, it's too easy. If you want to watch something, you could just press a few buttons and it's there on your computer. I think that's why I go to the cinema so much. I don't watch television because the adventure, it's the ritual, the pilgrimage, the journey that's involved. It's almost the risk. It's the effort involved. Things that are too easy to do somehow don't have that much cachet. It's almost as though it's dispensable. It's disposable. And what you're outlining there, you mentioned all the things that you didn't have, cash and the long journeys. You didn't have mobile phones in those days. But it sounded like you had a really good childhood.
Yes, in many ways. I enjoyed I enjoyed school on the whole. I was bullied quite a bit because I was nerdy, but not as much as people at other schools. My junior school was very nice, and then grammar school, apart from the fact that they thought they were a minor public school, and so there was an incredible amount of games, usually of a very unpleasant and violent kind, like rugby. Well, I couldn't understand why we couldn't play soccer, but soccer was for sort of working class kids who went to the secondary modern, as it was called then, when you all divided at 11. But I was in the top stream at grammar school, and certainly that was a sort of enormous privilege. I mean, I look back and I think how extraordinarily well taught I was, and how lucky I was to be going to a grammar school. I'm not sure that I approve of grammar schools as a universal system, and certainly not the 11 plus. But for people of a certain academic type, and many of even the kids at grammar school weren't really of this type, but for people who get excited about academic subjects, it was absolutely fantastic. We had a wonderful French master who went to France every summer, spoke perfect French. And his excitement and enthusiasm was amazing. I remember doing the poems of Baudelaire in the sixth form and enthusing to him about them. And I couldn't understand why he was so pleased. Well, I've taught for 50 years. I understand exactly, because I was probably one of the few boys who'd ever shown an interest in French poetry, which he loved. He just adored Baudelaire. Similarly, in English, you know, we did everything from Chaucer through to the 18th century. And, you know, looking back, I think, well, what happened to the 19th century realist novel? But in some ways, this was an enormous advantage, because these are things you typically wouldn't read unless you'd, you know, come across them at school. I mean, people don't pick up Chaucer and think, oh, this looks like a good read. Nor, you know, do they pick up Paradise Lost and think, oh, just, you know, skim through Paradise Lost. But I remember the first time I read the first two books of Paradise Lost, I just thought this was some of the most amazing poetry I had ever heard in my life. And I can still remember it. And we were also introduced to Joseph Conrad. Now, there's someone who people don't normally read. So we did Youth and Heart of Darkness, which must surely be one of the greatest novellas ever written. And so this started a lifelong interest in poetry, literature, and to some extent history. The history in English literature was much more interesting than the ghastly stuff taught in the history department. I can't now tell you, but there was something called the Treaty of Utrecht, in which various bits of Europe were chopped up and redistributed. And then there was another treaty in which the same bits of Europe were redistributed again. And my view was, who gives a?
Well, do you know, you're the second person that I've interviewed this week who's mentioned Joseph Conrad. So, but there is something about the curriculum, because I did lots of Chaucer and, of course, The Partner's Tale. Of course, now that I'm in Canterbury, that has a particular resonance. Jane Austen. Actually, I did enjoy Jane Austen, but there's nothing worse sometimes than when you're not quite ready. I mean, at the age of 14, was I ready for Macbeth? Maybe just about, because the teacher was very animated and he showed us the Polanski film. I'm not sure he should have done. I'm sure it's an 18 reading. And I know there was a young Keith, Keith Chegwin in there. but he did make it sort of come alive a bit. But in later years, you mentioned Dante. I mean, I teach on a module on death and the afterlife, and so Dante comes into that, and the concept of Beatrice is if ever somebody interviews me, I'll ask me about Beatrice, which is the rosebud of Citizen Kane that in my life, and who she might be. But you are right, and I think sometimes you have to find the right level. It sounds as though you were completely you know, ready for it when you were young.
A lot of work.
I'm not sure. I can't say, not so much that I wasn't, but it was more like I feel with film. I go to the cinema a lot because I get a lot out of it for all sorts of reasons, but it's sort of, it's self-directed. If somebody said to me, you have to see this film, that film, the other, I would feel it as an imposition and I wouldn't like it. I do a lot of reading now and it's a pleasure, but when I was younger, there was always that sense that if you don't do this, you're going to fall behind in some way. And there's a lot of expectation bound up with that. And it's funny because I followed an educational journey and I've, you know, jumped through all the right hoops. But I think sometimes, particularly when you're at school, it puts a lot of people off and they are deterred from reading some of the great classics because they associate it with getting a bad grade in some cases, or having a teacher tell them off because they haven't read all of the sonnets.
Yes, or they haven't, you know, particularly enjoyed this book. And you might conclude, you know, all books of this, by this author or of this age are equally awful.
Well, that said, though, I did D.H. Lawrence. I think we did Sons and Lovers, but I read Lady Chatterley's Lover, and I've read Nottinghamshire, yeah, of course, you know. And I did, at the time, one of the excitements there was because we knew it had been banned. It made it all the more, well, actually, there's another reason to read it. And yeah, in other words, more to see what the controversy was all about.
Yes.
But of course, you're also reading a work of a great fiction. It's not yeah, pornography. but actually, in a way, the controversy around it did single it out as something that the establishment didn't like. We saw the school as the establishment, so therefore in reading that, it meant that under the cover of orthodoxy, we were able to do something a little bit subversive. When you're 15 or 16, actually, you'll take what you can get.
Yes, there is this theory that the way to get people to read things is to ban it.
Yeah.
So, for example, when you couldn't read the Bible in your native tongue, people, you know, risked burning at the stake in order to produce it. And then when you could read it, you know, people just put it on the shelf and it would lie there gathering dust.
Yeah.
I was interested in what you said about going to the cinema rather than the television, and about the sort of journey and the experience. So I came to appreciate opera fairly late in life, probably in my 40s. I have a friend who's opera mad, and you know, he kept trying to persuade me. I said, I know it's irrational, but you know, the idea of someone singing when they're dying of TB is just too silly. I said, I know it's irrational because, you know, when people have just been stabbed with a poisoned rapier, they don't spout in blank verse saying, I've sent thee from Felicity a while. But I can sort of take it in Shakespeare, and I can't take it in opera. So he finally took me to see Eugene Onegin, and I was completely bowled over by this. But then I became a sort of opera purist, and you could only go and see opera in the theatre. And I had friends who were in Tallahassee who were very keen on all sorts of forms of music and would go to the Live at the Met performances. And I said, well, surely, you know, it's not, you know, like being at the opera. I mean, you've been to the opera. You know, it's just... And they said, no, actually, we think it's better. So I went along and I don't know how they did, because I actually was there on a Saturday when they were recording. You can't see any cameras, but they have 30 cameras. And the production values are just amazing, particularly considering it's live. So, of course, you get to see things that you couldn't possibly see sitting in a seat. Right? You get close-ups. I think acting in opera has improved enormously because of this. But what interested me was that being in a darkened cinema, rather like being in a theatre, meant total absorption. So we now subscribe to, you know, a Metropolitan Opera, which you can now stream any opera to your TV. I hardly watched any because it's like you watch an act and then you sort of feel you have to get up and make a cup of tea or something, or you watch the rest tomorrow, and it completely breaks up the immersion. So the things I remember most vividly are the times when I've been either in a theatre or a cinema completely immersed. So one of perhaps the greatest cinematic experience I ever had was going to see Abel Gance's Napoleon. And a friend of mine, who was chairman of a film society at Kiel, said, you know, we've got to go and see this. So I said, oh, well, okay, you know, I suppose it's one of these, you know, great moments. So I came to Stoke and they had an orchestra and, you know, they played the music that had been specially composed to go with the movie. And as the day approached, I thought, 6 hours of silent movie. 6 hours. And I can't leave because I'm with this guy, you know. So you know, I'm just going to have to sit there and nobody is going to say anything in this movie. Well, it was just fantastic. I can remember nearly all of it. But sort of imaginativeness of the cinematography, but also the fact that you were just, you know, completely immersed in this total hokum about, you know, Napoleon, the great hero of all these made-up scenes. Like, one of them is a snowball fight where the young Napoleon, you know, leads his classmates in a snowball fight against the larger boys and so on. But of course, because it was an imaginative movie, you could appreciate it much more on the artistic level. And then at the end, there's he has three screens, an essentially invented CinemaScope. Now, you know, I've seen lots of CinemaScope, so why was I blown away by this one? Well, because of the way he did it. So you get the CinemaScope and you get three different things going on. And all the symbolism, most of which disappeared for a long time from cinema once people could open their mouths. So after Napoleon has lost the snowball fight, he weeps on a cannon and the eagle of France lands on the cannon and consoles him. And then every time he's on some great campaign, you see not you know, the eagle, but the shadow of the eagle's wings. Reminded me of the first version of Cat People, where you don't actually see the Black Panther. You just see the shadow of the Black Panther, which is much more evocative.
Well, to this day, as I was recently asked if I could list my, you know, my favourite 10 films of all time, and a conversation arose. It wasn't one of my choices, but a friend was talking about Reservoir Dogs, and she said it was the film that she either did leave the cinema or came close to leaving. But of course, that's the film where it's what you imagine seeing rather than what you actually see. You see the effects of horrendous, part of the body being taken off, and you don't actually see it, but you see the consequences and all the noises that go with it. And that's really interesting. So and the film was banned for a while, or at least I didn't know that. Yeah, it was. Well, it was certainly... Well, it sort of coincided with all the Jamie Bulger, the tragedy of 1993. So when I say banned, I think it may have been the case that it was its video release was put back, so it was put on hold, and I don't think the distributors knew what to do with it. But of course, like with Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, if you ever did get a chance to see it, and you knew you were watching this like bootleg version, it became a ritual event. And when I went to university in 91, very early on in the second semester, they showed in the arts hall the Clockwork Orange, and because we weren't supposed to be watching it because Kubrick had banned it, then everybody went. You know, it was full to the rafters in there, and that's the same sort of thing. And it's the things that you'd never get if you just sit and watch it on your laptop.
Yes.
And it's the event of that, and it's being around people knowing that there's a shared event, and like, you know, we could be raided any minute. The police may come in and arrest somebody. But it was astonishing, and I do wonder sometimes that although in so many ways it's great that, you know, we can press a button and we can communicate with someone on the other side of the world, and there are opportunities open to us that weren't there just 2-3 decades ago, I do feel that you have to literally go the extra mile or the extra 20 miles. And it might even entail going to a particular cinema, because, you know, I've got some friends who are quite snooty that, you know, they won't go to some of the multiplexes because of the type of person who might go there. They might pay that little bit extra to go to the slightly more refined place where, sure, it's a bit more expensive, but it's a bit more classy. And that's absolutely fine, because, you know, you pay your money, you take your choice. But at the end of the day, it's the acknowledgement of an event and the structure. In the same way, this concept of working from home, I may be alienating some of my colleagues from saying this, but I've never understood it. For me, going to work and being seen to be at work and meeting people and interacting with people is part of the exercise. But even like recording lectures, the thought of recording a lecture, we have to record our lectures and, you know, we deliver them and then record them and a student can watch them afterwards. But the thought of me saying, I'm not going to be there on Thursday, so here's the recorded version, like on Blue Peter, the version I made earlier. I would, if I was a student, I'd feel literally quite shortchanged.
Yes, and I do. That was the precipice of nostalgia for you. So when I started university teaching, it wasn't thought necessary to teach people how to teach. After all, they were teaching their own subjects. So why would they need any special training? Then my third year at Keele, they decided that there should be a small, short course. It lasted 2 days. Largely produced by educationalists. I cherish it to this day. I didn't enjoy it at the time, but looking back, it was the most hilariously awful performance I've ever been at, and convinced me that people, all those jokes about people who can do and people who can't teach and people who can't teach other people to teach, are true. So we had Professor Elton, who may or may not be the father of Ben Elton, anyway, who's a very distinguished figure, who lectured for an hour and a half about how student attention spans were only 20 minutes. So it was pointless to have the hour-long lecture. He then, to show his superior grasp of latest technical skills, used one of those, used an overhead projector and one of those sort of acetate roller things where you write something and then you roll it on a bit and you write the next thing. And he wrote in light yellow pen, so in ordinary handwriting, so it was completely illegible. Then followed an even more wonderful performance by the education department. It was just about the time John Cleese was producing all these amazing videos about how not to do things. And of course, one way you learn is not by being shown how to do it, but by being shown how not to do it, because that's just indelible. So we solemnly watched this video of a seminar in the education department, of the first seminar of students returning after the summer vacation in the second, third year. And so the first thing that happened was the tutor said, now I want you to discuss these passages, so I'm going to hand them out. So he handed them out. And then we watched 10 minutes of video of students reading these handouts. I thought, you know, this is brilliant, because the people had said, now whatever you do, don't give people material in a lecture. I'd have said, yeah, yeah. But being made to sit through this, you know, was so excruciating. I was kind of burned into your soul. And it went on like this. So at the end, people started coming up with suggestions. And I was expecting him to say, yes, I'm glad you spotted that, because that was bad practice. So his first question was, couldn't you have given the students the information in advance? And he thought about this for a few seconds and he said, yes, that would have been a good idea. I hadn't thought of that. So that was my teacher training. Otherwise, it was all, you know, Nellie's knee. I remember first time I had to mark finals papers when everything depended on these six or seven papers you took at the end of your career. But, you know, I said, well, how do I know whether something is a good paper or a bad paper? And even more, how do I know whether, you know, it's an upper second or a lower second? Or, and they said, you'll pick it up. And to this day, I said, I think, and they said, they did say, actually, well, if you're really concerned about this, we do have last year's papers with the marks on, so you could go and look at them. But, I mean, no one said, sort of sat me down and said, you know, this is what, you know, a first looks like. And I noticed at Tallahassee, where we had all these graduate students doing the grading and so on, well, they were much tougher than I was. Because you assume that a student paper is going to look something like what you produced when you were a student. And since we're all a self-selected group of philosophy nerds, of course we all think, well, why didn't the student get this elementary point and mark them down? It took me years to realise that, you know, what the correct standard was. And you do pick it up. But I didn't like this idea of practising on the students, much as if, you know, you were learning to be a doctor and they said, right, appendectomy, well, here's the knife. You say, I don't know what to do. They say, we will soon pick it up.
No,
might
you're right.
Kill a few people.
But I remember somebody once saying, well, you can smell a first.
Yes.
But we actually came up with a
system.
Well,
actually, firsts are not that difficult.
No.
But firsts looked like the sort of thing I'd written.
Well, we came up with a system a few years ago where it's called the 21, or it's now a 22-point scale, where we don't give 53s or 54s, but we give a 52 and a 55 and a 62, 65, 68. And it actually works, because once you know what band something's in, you can say, okay, this is definitely a 2-1, but is it low 2-1, mid 2-1, or high 2-1? So you don't have to worry anymore about the, is it 63 or is it 64? Yeah. Because those become relative, because if you give it something 64, then the next paper you think, well, actually it's a little bit weaker than the other one, I'll give it 63. But now we go for clear, it's clearer boundaries.
Yes.
And there's lots to be said for that. But you are right. I think that it was assumed in my case that because I was doing a PhD, I didn't have the PhD, that I could do first year seminars and I could mark essays.
Yeah.
And I got some amazing help. Yeah. I wasn't for a minute. You know. But at the end of the day, I did sort of feel, well, not long ago, literally just a year or two, I was a student writing essays and hoping to get a good mark for my tutor, and now I'm the person grading other people's assignments.
Yeah.
And because I was still a student myself, and Lampeter was such a small place, I'd go down the bar of an evening.
Yeah.
I had a student union card. I was entitled to be there. Yeah. But of course, the students who were only a few years younger than me, who I was teaching, were also down there. And there were one or two cases when a student would say, I don't know if I should be saying this as you're having your pint, but I do think that 68 was unfair, and it was definitely worth at least a 72. And what do you say? Come to my office tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's very awkward. But those are the sort of conversations we had. But I think, so two lessons there. First of all, don't go down the pub with your students. And the second one is have a marking scale, as we now do, which at least has a certain, I'm not going to use the word objectivity, but at least there's a certain structure and a cohesion. You know, there's a mechanism in place which we should all be adhering to.
I'm not a big fan, actually, of these complicated marking schemes either, because often when you add up all the sums, the answer isn't anything like your overall judgment. You know, these things that say, you know, so much for content and so much for structure. And anyway, they all involve judgment. So, you know, you might as well, it's like saying, first of all, you say, Chris, was it a good movie? And then you say, you know, well, what did you think of the direction? And, you know, who was the best actor? And so on. But if you just sort of started from, you know, the director, the actors, and so on, you might end up thinking, well, I'm grading this movie higher or lower than the total package. And I actually had a colleague who moved to the dark side, went from teaching to administration, and his goal in life was to have a value-free scheme of marking. So the student could, as it were, see, even if they didn't understand what was good and what was bad, where they'd gone wrong. And I kept trying to explain to him, you know, if you squeezed value out in one place, it just reappeared somewhere else. So you say, well, let's say something like, paragraphing, right? So one thought per paragraph, right? But now, what constitutes one thought, right? Well, to some extent, you'd be able to tell, something about the structure and so on. So my favourite story of this was there's a vicious website on, a private website on Facebook called Students Say the Darndest Things. I tend not to read it because I think it's really very cruel. But one was somebody who, the instructions were, explain Locke's primary secondary quality distinction in your own words. And the student got a very bad grade. So he went to see the tutor, and the tutor said, well, why do you think you should got a higher grade? And he said, well, you asked me to explain it in my own words, and I did.
Well, that's why we always have to be careful, isn't it?
Explain it well in your own words, well, but no more can.
No, because I was once told, when you set exam questions, don't ask a question like, do you think Nietzsche was wrong? Because if a student says yes, you say, well, they've answered the question.
Yes.
They say, well, I answered the question, I should get a full mark. So you didn't ask me to elaborate or critically assess.
There's no doubt apocryphal story about AJ whose exam included, when he was a student, is this a question? Which is a clever Oxford way of asking you to talk about self-referential statements. And Eyre is supposed to have written, if this is a question, then this is an answer. Full stop. And I said, no, he would not have got a first for doing that. I mean, the examiner would have been very well disposed to what followed, because it's an excellent joke. But believe me, you don't go first for making an excellent joke.
No. Well, I'm still working on that one. Yeah. But how did you end up then in academia? Was it inevitable? Was it? Because it sounds like you're so learned. You loved reading.
Looking back, yes. So my maternal grandfather was a teacher. My mother was a teacher, my father was a teacher. So, of course, I decided the one thing I knew I didn't want to be was a teacher. But I was thinking of school teaching. I remember when I left grammar school, they said, so what do you think you're going to do after your university degree? And I said, oh, that's right, I was going to do philosophy and English. And I said, well, I don't know. And they said, well, you could always come back, and teach. And I thought, this is the height of ambition for them, isn't it? If you're really, really good, you could come back to the same school and do it again. So the beginning of this was that my mother was one of the first female students to take English at Edinburgh University. So she started back in 1929, and she was very, very good. I think she should really have got a first. But rather like Oxford, nobody ever told you what you were doing. So she didn't study enormously hard because she just assumed, But anyway, English literature generally was, what really excited me. English literature, French literature. So I said, oh, I'll go do English. And she said, well, if you do English on its own, you're going to end up doing things like Anglo-Saxon and Old Icelandic, which was true then. I'm sure you can get away with it now, but back then you did have to do. So taking too much notice of one's parents and their expert advice, I thought, no, well, I wouldn't want to do that. Actually, I think I would have loved to. Anglo-Saxon old Icelandic, but never mind. So she said, why don't you do English as something else, as a joint degree? And I said, what is that, you know? She said, well, something you haven't done at school. So I said, well, you know, what? And she said, well, how about philosophy? So I said, classic question, what's philosophy? And she said, I don't know, but lots of my friends at Edinburgh did it, and they all enjoyed it. It involves a lot of arguing. You'll like that. Which I had no idea I was argumentative, but apparently I was. Anyway, so I went and had various interviews for English and philosophy, and generally speaking, the philosophy interviews went well, and the English interviews didn't. And the English people were clearly looking, you know, to cut people out, because English was the thing to take back in 1964, and philosophy wasn't. So I finally went to Newcastle upon Tyne, and the philosophy department there, you know, wouldn't let me out of a room. They just kept talking to me about philosophy. And then, you know, finally they said, well, you're going to enjoy this. But the English department insisted that I get an A in English, and I got a B. So I ended up doing a general degree, which I wasn't very happy about. But it had a huge advantage. I had an extra year. So I've never forgotten this. My very first lecture in philosophy, well, going back to lecturing, what do I remember? Do I remember books I've read? No. Do I remember podcasts I've heard? No. What do I remember? I remember the lectures. I could tell you almost word for word what my lecturer said 50 years ago because of this, you know. So this chap, who looked exactly like the professor in Back to the Future, came in and started trying to persuade us that we had no reason to think there were any tables and chairs. And I thought this was utterly absorbing, not because I was inclined to think there weren't any tables and chairs, but because you could discuss this sort of thing intelligently. And, you know, you didn't have to learn all these facts before you could start. You could join in day one. You could have your view. You could argue your side. You know? So I thought, that's it, philosophy. And then I thought, well, perhaps I'd better not rush into this. So I went in for the second lecture. And I looked around the class, and there's all these people, and I'm like, where am I? What's going on? And I'm just, you know, totally, completely immersed in this stuff. Well, this is another bit of nostalgia. Back then, universities were very small. I think about 3% of the population went to a university. So you got a lot of personal attention, and especially in the philosophy department, for two reasons. One was they really were very small. They had 4.5 staff and an average of about 10 students in each year. But mine was the mega year, when we had 8 people doing single philosophy, which is what I ended up doing, and 8 people doing it joint with something else. And the students were also very keen. And the staff had this amazing attitude, you and I were talking about this earlier, that their job was to teach people and enthuse a new generation with an interest in philosophy. And most of them did not publish unless they were forced to publish, because they thought it was a waste of everybody's time. If they hadn't got something radically exciting to say, why would you want to read them rather than read Kant or Spinoza or Plato or whoever it was who knew what they were talking about? So when they started the department, they decided they had to have a staff-student common room, which the university was not willing to provide. So they said, we need an extra lecture room, because, you know, we do a lot of lecturing in philosophy. And they have promptly turned this into a staff student common room with a coffee machine and, you know, everything else, called unimaginatively The Cave. And the staff went in here just as much as the students did. And you could start talking to the staff. I remember once going in, having a three-hour conversation with somebody about a philosophical topic. It was absolutely amazing. Well, back then, social workers had to do moral philosophy on the grounds that moral philosophy's got something to do with being ethical, which is disputable, but anyway. Because it was largely historical figures in moral philosophy, starting with Aristotle and going through to, I don't know, utilitarians or something. So there are 57 social workers, I think, and a few philosophers. And when we got to Kant, the social workers really, you know, they just could not, quite understandably, they could not take this. And I knew several of them because I was in a hostel with them. So one of them said, David, you seem to understand about this sort of thing. So, you know, can you explain Kant's moral theory? So I would sit down over lunchtime and do my best. And after this had happened two or three times, I thought, you know, you can get paid for doing this. And then I looked up the salary of a university lecturer and thought, well, I'm clearly not doing this for wrong motives, because back then, particularly people who were starting, were so badly paid that some of them were given those kind of supplementary grants. I used to remember when you would have a supplementary grant if you had children, because the starting pay was so low that people couldn't afford to have a family. So I thought, my motives are pure. And then my thought was, I'll just, you know, carry on and see what happens. And no doubt at some point I'll get stopped, but, you know, why not? So looking back, it was sort of inevitable. Though, of course, I had no idea at the time. But here was a subject that was just clearly made for me. I did feel a little cheated because, of course, the people at Newcastle did the sort of philosophy that interested me. In particular, they thought philosophy was a footnote to Plato. And so the question of how we should live, of the transcendent values and so on, loomed very large. And then as I moved on, I discovered there were other aspects of philosophy that I had no interest in, like, does the sentence of the present King of France is bald have a truth value or not? And I was like, well, you know, you could go either way, and it doesn't make a heap of difference. Once you've seen the point that there's something odd about referring to something that doesn't exist, you might think, well, it's false because it makes a claim about the King of France and there isn't one. Or you could think it's neither true nor false because it doesn't sort of get off the ground making a statement. But people, you know, the amount of ink was spilled on this sort of stuff.
What is the branch of philosophy where you would pigeonhole yourself?
Ethics and philosophy of religion. Yeah. So the second degree was at Oxford. I was told firmly, if you want to get a job in philosophy, you have to go and take the BPhil at Oxford, which had been introduced by Gilbert Ryle, because they had decided, oh, this is so ironic, that people being released into teaching who had only done a doctoral dissertation was not a good idea. So they had the radical idea we might take further courses and sit exams. They still, of course, wouldn't do anything so lowly as teaching you how to teach. You know. More or less, getting the BPhil was a meal ticket. And I was at, so I applied to Magdalen College, which was my old English teacher's college. He'd taken us all around Oxford in hopes that, you know, some of us would apply for our first degrees at Oxford. And I said, no, no, I don't think I want to be with all these snobbish people, my first degree. And I said, I could always come back as a graduate student. Ho, ho. So there I was. So I was accepted. And then I got a message saying, you know, you're accepted for a BFL provided you get a first. And I thought, well, that's blown it then. But I had a second arrow in my quiver, which was London. But I did get a first, so I went to Oxford. And philosophically, I don't think that was a particularly wonderful experience. Culturally, it was just fantastic. I was, you know, one of the best periods of my life in terms of, you know, finding things that I enjoyed. But somehow I seemed to do enough philosophy to get through. And the slaughter rate was notorious. So there were about 36 people a year, and there was a 50% dropout failure rate. Mm. Largely dropouts, I think. Philosophy attracts people, rather like psychology, attracts people who are a bit weird. And, you know, many of them, I think, ended up, you know, having various existential crises. But people did fail as well. I was the last year when I think everyone who got the BPhil and applied for a job got something. And I got the last job that was going. Because, and this is an example of how people don't explain the fundamentals to you, just like not explaining to you how to lecture or how to teach. They didn't explain to you how to choose a subject. So I started off doing philosophy of language, all that stuff about, you know, whether the present king of France has a truth, the present king of France is bald as a truth value, because, and I'm putting it this way quite deliberately, because that was what real men did. And the weaker brethren, and the women, of course, of whom there were very few, did touchy-feely subjects like ethics and aesthetics and so on. So there was definitely this snobbery about what you did. So I thought, well, I'm going to get anywhere. I'll have to do, you know, philosophy of language. And I was just dreadful at it. And after three tutorials with Professor Strawson, probably the most distinguished philosopher after Quine in the English-speaking world, he and I came to a very rapid agreement that my work wasn't really up to standard. And I said, well, I don't really like philosophy of language. And he said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, ethics. So he said, well, do ethics then. So off I went to do ethics, feeling, you know, I had failed. But then when it came to the job market, there were 16 people who'd done metaphysics, epistemology, and philosophy of language, and two of us who'd done ethics and aesthetics. The other one was going back to Canada. So when a job came up in ethics, I turned out I was the only candidate. Mm. Now, you know, looking back, I think, how stupid could I have been? But it's the sort of thing that when you're young, you tend to think, I've got to do, you know, whatever is a sort of thought to be at the cutting edge of my subject. Indeed, I was a bit worried about this in Tallahassee, which is number one in the world for action theory and free will. We're just, yeah. And it rightly attracts an enormous number of graduate students who want to do action theory and free will. And there were just endless conferences about free will and so on, about 3 or 4 a year. But then many of them had great difficulty getting jobs, right? Because if you go out to a small college and they say, well, you know, what do you specialise in? And you say, well, you know, abstruse questions about freedom of the will. They're like, oh, yes. And, you know, could you teach, you know, existentialism? And could you teach Kierkegaard? And could, you know, the sort of things people do in small colleges. So I think probably not a good career move, and various people who, for example, moved into bioethics. And I'd say, well, you know, bioethics still expanding, lots of jobs outside academia as well as inside academia. Anyway, I think the answer to that is you just, you know, if you do what you really want to do, it almost always turns out well in the end. And if you do something because somebody else, you
know, yeah. To paraphrase, because it's the leap of faith.
Yes, it is the leap of faith.
Not perhaps in the way that he meant it, but in the context of the job line there as well.
I'm glad to see you've read one of the three important
little bit.
Pascal, William James, and Kierkegaard are people who most influenced me. I mean, that was another sort of revelation when I realised that there are considerations other than, you know, finally balancing all the arguments. But just, you know, whether you're a religious believer isn't like, you know, deciding do you think that substance dualism or property dualism is the correct theory of mind, because whichever you choose, it will make absolutely no difference to your life.
One thing that I was curious about was a moment ago you mentioned that there were some great cultural things going on when you were at university. Yeah. I think at Oxford particularly. Before we go to some appropriately more perhaps philosophically based questions, what were they? Did they involve, you know, sport, music, religion, film?
Oh, I see. Well, of course it was 68, so we were actually throwing paving stones about, but there was the Oxford Revolutionary Socialist Society, who most of us thought were just silly. And I do remember the only time I got involved at all in politics was the junior common room, where undergraduate students could go, was a, you know, a typical sort of mini gentleman's club. It was, of course, all male college back then. And, you know, we liked it that way, most of us. And then the revolutionary socialists decided, you know, we should have a political agenda and so on and so on. So we sort of did a sneak thing where, you know, we got all our chaps in and voted all the revolutionary socialists out of office. But they responded. It was very like being, you know, a rerun of Animal Farm. They responded by having a meeting at which they just kept talking until all the non-political people were bored and went to bed and then reinstated themselves. So I learned an important political lesson, which is if you can do this sort of thing, you know, you have to do it wholeheartedly. But that was really the only politically interesting thing going on. Now, I was just blown away by Oxford, by the architecture, the music, the libraries. One of the things was I would work, or work in inverted commas, from sort of 9:30 until lunchtime, and then I would go and look for some lunch. So I'd walk down the high street, and at almost every college, some piece of chamber music was being performed in the college. So you think, oh, Mozart, I'll just pop in and listen to that. The other thing was, because I had been a staunch Methodist, but when I came to Magdalen, of course the chapel was Church of England and very, very traditional. And Magdalen College Choir were famous as a sort of source for, you know, people who went on to become quite distinguished singers in some cases. And again, it was all male voices. So I think there were 16 adult people in a choir and 16 schoolboys who came from the Magdalen Choir School. And it was the, I'm not even sure it was the 1928 prayer book. I suspect it was the 16th century prayer book. Anyway, it was, you know, it had all the old stuff in it, and it, there was occasional communion, but mainly it was choral evensong. So I'm about 4:45 every night. You could go into this magnificent chapel and hear some of the best singers in the world performing Tallis, Bird, Gibbons, and so on. It was just incredible. So I got very friendly with the music people. So that was what I really enjoyed. And I rather assumed I wasn't going to pass a philosophy course. So I thought, you know, I would do a decent amount, but not too much. So as not to, you know, have wasted my 2 years, which is probably a very sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nowadays I don't even get away with it. We just used to have to write essays and sit some exams. Students now have to produce sort of extended article-length essays which really look like the sort of thing that could be published. The downside of this was that, of course, I had no idea when I started how to write an article. I knew how to write an essay, but, you know, an essay is not some original piece of research, but your reflections on something you've been, you know. And of course, sitting an exam is a completely different technique. Goes back to your being focused again. I mean, get shut in this room, you have 3 hours, and I would just sort of go into automatic writing mode and keep going. But you can't write an article by doing that. But the good side was that I didn't think the academic pressure was quite as bad as it is now. Mm. And there was, I was also warned about the, you know, the one-upmanship. So there was academic one-upmanship. I've never forgotten an American PhD student when Peter Strawson finished giving some characteristically erudite talk, said, "Oh, Professor Strawson, in Chomsky's unpublished Harvard dissertation." So I got up and walked out. I mean, you know, this is just name dropping on a grand scale. It's not, none of the rest of us have read. You know, he didn't say Chomsky says somewhere, or I have heard, or, you know, I was just like. And there was some of that at college. I did hear. I think it was a sort of joke, but I once heard someone say, something along the lines of, "Oh, take no notice of Rodney, his grandfather was in trade." But you can only make that sort of joke if there's a kind of background. I mean, for, imagine doing it now, Kent University would fall completely flat. People wouldn't understand why it was funny, because people don't say anything like that.
No, and rather sadly, when you said that, I thought of a great Only Fools and Horses sketch, but that, which portrays my low class.
Well, it was definitely decline and fall, perhaps Brideshead revisited. The first night, of course, I just sat down on some table. And nobody told me about this, of course, but one of the most significant members of Magdalen College was Oscar Wilde. And as a result, it was one of the gay colleges. So we had quite a large gay community. So who just behaved like something, you know, a wonderful character in Brideshead Revisited. So, you know, and I just sat there thinking, I'm so glad I didn't come here as an undergraduate, because if I'd been 18, I would have, you know, wanted to run home to mummy. So so I hear you've had all sorts of problems with your tutor, Rodney. Oh, yes. Well, you know how it is. I mean, some days I'm ill and some days I, you know, weigh and so on, but I guess I have been through all the diseases now. I think I shall probably have to write an essay. Well, who was that lovely young man you were in bed with last term, Rodders? And this sort of went on, you know. And obviously it was all staged for my benefit. Unfortunately, you know, one of the things I was unbothered by, one of the things I discovered about Oxford was they may be very snobby about social status, but they're also very meritocratic. So if you're a postgraduate, you have proved that you've got the smarts, and that's that. I put my big foot in it once by saying to a group of about 16 people, we're having a very pleasant evening, I said, you know, I didn't want to come to Oxford as an undergraduate because I thought it'd be full of these frightful public school types, but really, you know, people are jolly nice and so on. And there was this sort of deathly silence. And I said, we can't all have been to public school. There was another deathly silence. So I said, okay, let's go around the room. Winchester, Eton, Harrow, Winchester, mainly Winchester. And I'm like, okay, sorry. But they were, you know. They weren't at all like I imagined to be.
Yeah. And my university experience was very different to that, when I think we were all predominantly state school.
Right. Yes, I was the grammar school lad. I felt like Alan Bennett.
Yeah. just a few questions to end with, I say to a philosopher, with a more philosophical bent, but you've brought nostalgia into this a couple of times, and I was just sort of thinking whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences, because there's a lot that you've drawn on, which is actually very positive. But I wonder, that sort of sense of things never quite going as you might imagine them to, or things falling short, do you sort of, you know, in terms of nostalgic reflections, how do you sort of fit with that whole sense of, you know, I suppose a related question to that, are your memories predominantly positive?
Well, a lot of negative things I don't think you can be nostalgic about. I don't think you've been nostalgic about, you know, being humiliated or feeling deeply lonely or whatever. But I suppose there is a sort of nostalgia, you're talking about, you know, the days before all these wonderful electronic devices. There is a sort of, you can, I think, have a sort of nostalgia about hardships which seemed bad at the time. But rather like, you know, when you've finished climbing and you come back down the mountain, the fact, you know, it was windy and cold and snowing was all part of a whole enjoyable experience. So I think, you know, things like shuffling snow off the drive or whatever, you can look back with a certain nostalgia and think, well, you know, in a way that was quite fun. Well, the fact we had very few books because books were expensive, and so I tended to reread the same books. And now I can afford to have an enormous collection of books, and I won't get to read all of them, even if I live to be 100 and start reading now and don't stop. And I'm thinking, well, you know, there was something to be said for the excitement of, you know, actually say getting a book for your birthday. So this is real nostalgia. I got the C.S. Lewis books as they came out. Right, and that was a huge, you know, a hardback book. It was really exciting, a wonderful present. And I'm nostalgic about that. And, you know, other people might think, well, you know, that was it. That was all you got for your birthday.
Because I think that something I'm not nostalgic about is boredom. You know, there are periods in my life when I sometimes think, oh, not much happened that year. Yeah. It could happen, say, working on a PhD, of course, where, you know, sometimes you have the best ambition, but something doesn't click into place, and you feel that you're wasting time, that there are challenges, but you're not making the most of them, or sometimes you just sort of find that you're switching off. And I feel, and I wonder if part of my regular trips to the cinema are part of this. It's a sense of always keeping busy, keeping active, having energy. Yeah. And sometimes I suppose you can get bored with the same structures, but we need structures in order to keep us going. Otherwise, this is the worry. If you sometimes just say, I'm going to sit down now. Yeah. What will you do? You'll fall asleep.
Yes.
And then if that ever happens to me, I feel I've lost the day. I can't get that day back. And I don't know where that's coming from. It's internal.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is sort of out there saying, Chris, you know, we're worried that you can't account for the last 20 minutes. But that sense of time being as precious, I suppose it's that the two different definitions of time, you know, chronos and kairos. It's the tick-tock time and the sense of make the most of it, you know, while you can. Very Ecclesiastes, I suppose, sort of based. But yeah, that's what you say is very interesting.
I think there's a difference between wasting time, which I do a great deal of, where wasting time consists of filling in, usually because I don't want to do something, from, you know, filing my income tax to, you know, starting writing again. So, and nowadays, of course, you have all the added distractions, so you can, you know, you can skim through Facebook, see what everybody's been up to. Mm. And there, I think, that's only a negative experience with hindsight. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it, right? I mean, I enjoy skimming through Facebook, so it's a temptation. Afterwards, I think I could have been doing something more productive, more focused, and so on. And I would probably have enjoyed it more than, you know, this enjoyable diversion. But boredom is ghastly. The only time I remember being bored is when I used to go and spend the summers with my mother. And I'd be full of good intentions to read, you know, 20 academic books. But, of course, that really would have required a degree of self-discipline I haven't got. So I would, you know, read all the great 19th century novels and go for long walks. And, you know, talk to my mother and watch television with her. But this would go on for week after week after week. And, you know, there were only three directions you could walk in from the house. It was on the Isle of Wight. It's very nice. You could go left along the coast or right along the coast or inland, right? But, you know, after 7 weeks, this begins to pall a bit. And then, you know, every time I was reading my third Charles Dickens, I'd be thinking, And they, I think, were periods, you know, that you look back on, and they were unpleasant at the time. And it wasn't that you were wasting your time, it's that you were frustrated because you couldn't think how to spend the time better. And since then, I've always been lucky enough to have, you know, plenty to do, keep me out of mischief.
Yeah. Two more questions. Mm. Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? Yeah, good. No, that's good. Wow, good. My, no. So that you get an A for that, a first class answer. Wow, we're up against the clock on this one. No. Yeah. No, but no. But would you say that? I mean, I suppose it's that whole sense. I mean, in a way, actually, it sounds as though you have you're quite fulfilled in the sense that you had a love of learning.
Mm.
You were very diligent. You read books. You followed a path. Mm. It may have been a subject that when you started out, you weren't quite sure where it was going to take you, but you ended up being a master of that subject.
Yeah.
And so it sounds as though you've got a lot, you know, it's a wonderful story, actually.
I do the sort of philosophy I really like. I've reached the age where I don't give a toss whether people, you know, are interested in this sort of thing or not. I've met a large number of people. Many of them have been very sort of helpful and supportive. I've had people I don't know sending me notes or messages saying, you know, how much they enjoyed something I'd written, which I still I find, you know, incredible but immensely enjoyable. I've been very fortunate in writing philosophy with other people, so I've written, I should think, something like 9/10 of my work in the last 20-something years has been written either with Piers Rawling or Eve Garrard. It's very, I understand I now understand about those ghastly fruit machines.
Oh, yeah.
I could never understand fruit machines. I was like, why would anybody sit there and pull a handle and watch these balls go around?
No,
Because on Facebook, it's very similar. You just keep rolling along and you think, I'm going to hit the jackpot. The next post I see is going to be something I'm really interested in.
And then
sometimes, of course, it is. Yeah. So you just like
it is no different to being at the seaside.
You get the occasional kick.
Yes,
from that.
You're right, because with my children, it was the same when I was young. You put those 2p's in, and of course, when you might be lucky that you put a 2p in, and you might get 2p's out, and you put them back in again. It's the same with Facebook. You find something you really want, and you say, well, look at that person's other post, and who are they tagged into here? Well, let me look that person up.
Yeah.
And on the, you know, I've been obviously travelling around Scotland doing these interviews, and I'm not going to deny a lot of the in-between time has been spent, you know, a combination of reading Hillary Clinton's book on why she lost to Donald Trump, and also trawling on around Facebook. But also I put up film reviews, and I'm doing a lot of reflection at the moment on films that I've seen over the last few decades, and then seeing people's comments on that. And one of the great joys of this interview series is catching up with people who I, inverted commas, know through Facebook, but then find that, of course, there's the digital, the avatar, and then there's the real person, and there's no substitute. So I think it's almost like a gateway, a portal. Yeah. Facebook gives you a way into people's eccentricities, idiosyncrasies, but it's never a substitute for the real person. And when my sister actually the other day asked if I was going to do any of these interviews through Skype, I thought, no, because that's not the challenge that I want to do.
Back
to our previous conversation about giving a lecture in front of a microphone.
I don't know what it is, but it's really weird. I actually don't like, you know, people say, why don't you have a video chat? And I'm like, well, it doesn't add anything. Yeah. And if anything, it's sort of slightly off-putting because I'm watching the face. But this sort of... I mean, I do learn a lot from Facebook. So there are a large number of rewards. But I try and remind myself, I heard someone say, you know, at any time, well, I mean, when I was young, not only were there no computers, but the chairman of IBM thought there might at most be 2 computers in the whole world. So any time before I was born, if you told people you could have something in your pocket which would give you access to all the information in the world and all the entertainment in the world, you know, they would have been amazed. And then, of course, the kicker was, and so what do they use it for? They use it for showing photos of their babies and pets, which I don't object to, and having arguments with people they've never met. And that one really got to me. So I thought, what is the point of my starting this or getting involved in this argument about Trump or Brexit or whatever? And then a whole lot of people pile in. And then I found myself getting really upset. Upset with people who I hadn't met, would never meet, you know. And they were being, you know, so grossly unfair. And I felt I then had to defend somebody else and... So I did at least get the self-discipline to cut that out. And I have discovered that Facebook is trainable. You know, there's that thing where you can say, hide this post and similar ones. Well, I've started doing that every time I get a political one.
Yeah.
And I'm getting far more, you know, cute animals, which I look at any time, pictures of landscape, which I look at any time, and people's reflections about film and book, which is probably one of the main things I go on for. Apart from, you know, sympathising with people or finding out what, you know, George is up to these days. But yeah, those are the things that I think Facebook is really excellent for. And when we all complain about it, I say, I've got friends who will not go on Facebook. They want to know what I'm doing. And I say, well, you know, you could go on Facebook, right? Because otherwise I have to write, you know, individual letters to each of them and then, you know, select photos from my hard disk and send them to each of them personally. Now, I'm sure that's better than Facebook, But it's a bit like a round robin Christmas letter. You know, what is worse, getting a round robin Christmas letter or getting no Christmas letter at all?
Well, I remember this debate coming up last Christmas as to whether you send your friends a happy Christmas on Facebook or Twitter, or you write a card, pop it in the post, see if the the post office is open, have the card weighed, all those sort of things. But, but sometimes it's still nice to do those things. But,
but you are only for special people, I think. Maybe, you know, our circle of acquaintance and friends has got too wide in one sense, and you can't sort of have deep and recurring friendships with more than a very few people. But you can have very fruitful relationships that fall short of that. Sometimes you say with people you have never met. So I've, you know, once or twice on Facebook, and I've got quite chatty with someone who says, well, of course, you know, we never met as far as I know, but, you know, and then they start, you know, saying the sorts of things people used to say in pen pal letters. So perhaps it's rather like having a large number of pen pals, but without the hassle of having to write each one and write it in a foreign language.
Absolutely, and I get very protective as well of the number of friends I have. If ever the number falls or something, you know, and often there's an innocuous reason for it. Somebody's gone off Facebook for whatever reason, but I sometimes think, have I posted something? Does somebody not like my film? Did somebody, no, like,
how
somebody
many,
watch?
Does somebody not like, have you got?
I've got 230.
Oh, yes, well, I suppose you could. Yeah. I mean, I've reached the sort of upper 800s or something.
Oh, good
and,
heavens.
And most of them, I know, you know, I will never see a post from them. Sometimes I go through and think, damn Facebook, you know, go and look somebody up so I'll see their post. And some of them I only, you know, my principle was I'd accept anyone who I knew and anyone who I didn't know who was clearly sort of embedded in the philosophy profession, and so was friends with lots of my philosophy friends. They didn't have to have an academic post. I mean, they could just be interested or whatever. So, you know, on an everyday Facebook will say, you know, so-and-so is having a birthday today, and I think, who the hell is this? I suppose this is one of my Facebook friends.
But if you've got 800 friends, then on that basis, you must have two or three a day.
Yes, so, but I mean, least, you know, I know most of them because I don't know who they are, and I assume they're hoping that I'm not going to just post, you know, pictures of cute animals, but say something philosophically profound. I tend not to do that on Facebook, actually. I do have a blog, which I very rarely blog on. But, you know, I figure if people want to go read that sort of thing, they can read it. And I don't... these people start having philosophical discussions on Facebook. The trouble is, a good philosophical discussion involves two or three people.
And often,
once you have 18, it just, I mean, I don't know who's replied to who or what the point is, and half of them think, what's the point?
Yeah, and in a way, it's the
just not a good word.
And it's the antithesis of the way we do things in education, where you're quoting sources and you're checking references.
Yes.
You're not just saying things off the top of your head. There's a place for that.
Yeah.
A diary is a good place for that. But in, and yes, of course, you can have an academic debate on Facebook, but it would take a different sort of form. But sometimes you feel, well, you know, if you're a specialist in a particular area, that's your forte. There's no point sometimes trying to take on too many different forms of commitment. It's, you know, sometimes we just have to be precious with our time and the direction of our energy and resources. But yes, I think Facebook can be overwhelming. But one final question.
Okay.
I think we're doing super well.
We're
doing really well, but we're still going. But it was whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Oh, gosh. Well, this is a rather trite thought, but I guess when I was younger, I was mainly looking forward. So I have lots of regrets about people I didn't keep up with. because I had sort of moved on to the next stage. So I didn't keep up with the professor who looked like the guy from Back to the Future, until he died, when I went, to his sort of memorial service and so on. And I thought, well, why the hell am I going to his memorial service? Why didn't I go and see him before then? As I get older, I just the opposite. I spent an enormous amount of time looking back, particularly wondering what happened to X and what happened to Y, and in some cases actually doing something about it. So I did track down, it's not always successful, of course, I tracked down a couple of old school friends and somebody from university, and it was nice to find out what they were doing. But it was obvious that, we weren't going to sort, we were just very different people. But I was glad to know what was going on in their lives. I think I spent too much time doing the what if I had, done this rather than that, which is another form of looking back. And some of it is, cases where I think I really could have been more adventurous, and I wished afterwards I had been more adventurous. I think that's rather pointless. But I think looking back on things you really enjoyed, again, it's a fairly trite thought, but kind of retrospective enjoyment. You were talking about prospective enjoyment, about, it's more exciting to travel than to arrive. But it's also sometimes more exciting to look back on something. Me telling you about Abel Gance's Napoleon. There are things that kind of stick in your mind, and whenever they come back up, they not only remind you of things that you care about, but sort of trigger a whole lot of associations. So I wouldn't recommend reading Heart of Darkness as, a fun read. But nevertheless, I have returned to that book over and over again, having, first read it in school when I was 16. And I can recite whole chunks of it. It's a bit like poetry. And so it's a bit like sort of, you can't, unless it's very bad food, you can't sort of retaste it once you've eaten it. Right? But you can retaste all these things in memory. So I'm hoping that, when I get older and dodderier, I can still, enjoy reminiscing. Unless, of course, I go completely gaga, in which case I won't be remembering anything. I'd be like the chap who had Alzheimer's, and his wife knew he liked a certain kind of book. So she brought him his book, and he read it. He said, oh, it was wonderful. So she went to the library, renewed it, brought it back. He read it again. He read it every week for the rest of his life and said, I don't know how you always know which book I like. I hope it doesn't end up like that, because it probably wasn't so bad for him, but there's something dreadful looking, someone who's lost all those things. I mean, I lose a lot. I have friends who say, you remember when we went to see Judi Dench in The Tempest and, we ate at so-and-so and had fried chicken? I'm like, what? Some cases I can't even remember. the things that made a strong impression remain. And maybe it's because you process them, but they kind of grow in the memory. And possibly in some cases, of course, you shouldn't go back and re-experience them, because they're much better in memory. You just remember them.
Well, on that bombshell and very learned note, David McNaughton, thank you very much.
Thank you.